Welcome to Banned Book Club. I'm Nick, this is Thomas, and today we're going to be talking about Fight Club, specifically the book and movie versions of Fight Club. Just a quick introduction for Thomas here. Thomas is a dear friend, a treasure trove of priceless information, and a registered cinephile.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand you've brought trivia.
A little bit, yeah. What some stuff I could dig up, you know. Hopefully, it'll be entertaining for y'all. So,
well, I think this is going to be an interesting discussion because if you want to talk about books versus movies, I think maybe with the exception of Less Than Zero from Bret Easton Ellis, I've never seen a movie by the end divert as much from the message of its source material, I think, as Fight Club.
Wow. Okay.
But we're going to hash that out. We're going to get into the weeds, into the, the dirty nitty gritty.
The jungle vines.
But yeah. Okay. But you haven't read the book, right?
That is correct. Yeah. And if I could perhaps interject with my first little dose of trivia.
Oh, please, please. We're waiting.
Yeah. I discovered, so obviously one of the leads in the film, Brad Pitt, playing Tyler Durden. He's collaborated with David Fincher on a couple other films, obviously Seven, as well as Benjamin Button. And he also had an uncredited bit part in a film adaptation of Less Than Zero.
Brad?
Yes. Yeah. He had the 1987 film.
That?
Small uncredited role. Some kind of like guy at a party or something, a frat guy. But yeah. So first fun fact.
Oh, he's handsome.
Yes.
Handsome man.
That's right. But yeah, I'm very interested to hear about this divergence between book and film.
Yeah, well, just to bring you up to speed, I mean, Brad's kind of a dumb guy. I think he's a great actor. But I mean, one of the things he really brought out in the movie was the aspect of Tyler where he's just so super cool at first. But this is the turning point for the movie and the book is...
Okay.
In the movie, you're kind of rooting for him the whole time. And you're almost disappointed at the end where, you know, he doesn't get away with everything he wanted and, like, resetting society back and liberating everybody. But the book goes just a little bit further than the ending scene of the movie where the buildings are coming down.
Okay.
And you find out that it wasn't the Edward Norton character thwarting Tyler by shooting himself in the head. Instead, the buildings don't blow up at all. And it turns out just to be the result of Tyler's own incompetence. Like, he just ends up mixing the explosives wrong. So it's kind of this...
sort of undercuts.
It kind of, like, takes the piss out of his whole deal there. And then the final scene of the book is the most important because... It shows you the Edward Norton guy in an insane asylum, and he doesn't end up getting the girl like he does at the end of the movie.
Yeah, although I suppose that's ambiguous. They do hold hands, but...
But he's in this insane asylum, and he thinks it's heaven.
Oh, wow.
And you get the sense that he's still pretty miserable, that this whole alter ego of his ended up defeating him instead of, like, in the movie, like, taking him on this one, like, wacky fun ride. And he thinks he's in heaven, and the last thing we get is one of the orderlies is kind of winking at him that he's, you know, waiting, he's part of Project Mayhem and waiting for him to come back.
Wow.
Totally different messages there.
Yeah Much more explicit kind of condemnation and I don't know, a painting, kind of a pathetic portrait of the group and their activities and their ethos.
It ended up being more about, you know, this whole psychological process for this guy was just a big implosion and ended up making his life and everyone else's life worse.
Yeah. Wow, interesting. Yeah, and as far as... differences between original novel and film adaptation go, one comparison that jumped out to me, and let me know if you guys touched on this in your main episode, was Fight Club versus Clockwork Orange. and the changes that happened from book to film. And it seems like especially regarding the ending, the final sort of chapter, and how that affects the overall thesis of the film.
I haven't read the Clockwork Orange book in like 10 years, so
yeah,
and I don't remember the difference.
Well, and so that's the thing, is that depending which edition of the book you got, there might not be a difference. So if I recall correctly, you know, Anthony Burgess wrote the novel, and when it was published in the U.S., they cut off the last chapter. And the last chapter is Alex DeLarge, the main character, having gone through his whole experience being this horrible delinquent, you know, criminal guy, getting put in prison, going through this brain therapy that, you know, forcibly denied him from doing, you know, evil or violent acts by you know, causing this sick reaction, you know, and all that. But, you know, this sort of artificially enforced, right, exactly, you know, corrupted his beloved Ludwig van, but enforcing this artificial morality on him, which I understand that's kind of the Clockwork Orange, is the idea of, like, you know, man's morality, man's free will being this natural fruit, you know, this God's creation. And then what they do in the plot is they try to engineer an orange. They try and make an orange out of clockwork.
But what I remember from the movie ending is that he ends up pretty much okay. Like, yeah, he's like eating snacks in a hospital bed with a smile on his face or something, right?
Right. There's a big uproar about the procedure that was done to him. He becomes like, you know, a cause celebre. And
what's the difference with the book?
Yeah, they remove his affliction or whatever. So in the book, that all happens. But then time continues on, life continues on. There's, I think, maybe a time jump. He's sort of separated from the droogs. He's walking down the street one day, and he discovers one of his droogs in a cafe going on a date with a girl who's sort of clean cut, dressed like a normal person. And he sort of goes in and says hi, and it's like, oh, wow, yeah, it's like, you know, old times and all that. And basically, Alex grows up and becomes more of a normal person. And I think there was an essay from Anthony Burgess about how, you know, one of the ideas he wanted to explore is how much easier it is to destroy than to build. But as you grow old and maybe more mature and hopefully become a more moral person, you realize the value of building and creating, you know, even though it's much more laborious and less sort of immediately gratifying, you know?
Yeah, well, that ending changes everything, like in Fight Club. I kind of feel like now, since you told me that, it's the same as the, you know, Edward Norton shooting himself in the face thing. It just kind of undermines the whole point of the book, almost.
Right.
And not that they're not both very entertaining,
yeah,
good movies, or maybe you don't think so. We can get into that, too. But
no, yeah.
And I think, too, I mean, the kind of sympathy the movie lends to Tyler is maybe the door for all this memification of him and like the Sigma male,
right,
fetishism of him. And
yeah,
in a way that doesn't really hold water from a reading of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in both cases, I think the book's ending are kind of more optimistic.
Exactly, yeah.
Than the movie.
Maybe more conventional, people might argue. They might find it more less interesting if they're kind of like really looking for like an edgy, cynical thing. But yeah, more optimistic, more humanistic.
More to digest, but in the end, like, you know, more value. And right. But that's the tricky thing with movies, because I think one factoid I remember about the movie was they had written it that way in the original script with the insane asylum scene at the end for Fight Club. And one of the producers or somebody just said, you know, the way we've got Tyler in this book, he's killing people. He's destroying all this stuff, which they de-emphasize in the movie. But they said, we need to make him more of a relatable character. So we can't have him doing, you know, some of the murder stuff that he does in the book.
Oh, really? Okay.
And
more reprehensible stuff. They go into more explicit detail in the book, huh?
Yeah, and they even changed the final goal of Project Mayhem from, like, killing a bunch of people in these buildings and destroying a museum.
Oh, wow.
To something they thought people could get more on board with, which was resetting the credit card company's computers.
Right, erasing all this consumer debt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty radically different.
Yeah, I mean, they made him the hero. And that's what I'm saying is, like, I understand why people, especially if you don't read the book, it's like the same thing with, well, maybe a little different than American Psycho, but looking just through the lens of the movie, you can almost see why people would, like, I don't know, deify this character.
Right, right.
Especially young, confused guys. But
yeah, and just something about it, it's sort of like the Francois Truffaut quote about war movies. Like, you know, there's no such thing as an anti-war movie because the cinematic form and the cinematic language will always inherently glorify it and make it sexy and make it look attractive in some way. And that sort of same axiom can sort of be applied to this case, where just like him looking good on film is going to have some kind of attractive power and some kind of seductive element, you know, and that's sort of this tension that has to be negotiated. But yeah, it's really interesting how the degree of parallels that I see, at least between Clockwork Orange and Fight Club, where there were significant changes to the end of both stories. When they were adapted to film. And then as a result, both films were very controversial and there was a lot of outcry and fear of like copycat crimes and so on. And in the case of Clockwork Orange, there was, I believe, at least some kind of alleged copycat crime. And then this is sort of apocryphal, but I feel like it's probably a pretty safe bet that there were a lot of like teenage fight clubs that sprouted up.
Well, that's one thing Chuck talks about in the afterword of the book is that that was kind of a phenomenon,
yeah,
especially after the movie. There were even women fight clubs. Oh. But he also qualifies that saying that there are third world sort of societies that have been doing this since time immemorial too, stuff like that.
Yeah,
like just,
sure.
You know, men congregating over...
blood sport.
Yeah, it's a thing that's always been around because it's kind of a natural part of men's development in some ways, like this integration of violence. And he was saying, like, the original impetus for starting the book, a big part of it was, you know, there was all this stuff in it, if we're talking movies, in the 90s where women were coming together doing pretty much the same thing. They were bonding and having this communion. But it was like the Yaya sisterhood,
or sister of the traveling pants.
That too. And he said the only other thing that was really like that maybe was Dead Poets Society or in larger culture, golf. But
yeah, well, amongst the upper strata, perhaps. Yeah, you know, the ownership class or the executives or what have you. Yeah, which I feel like, yeah, if you want to take maybe like a, I don't know, like sociological angle to it, you could sort of maybe attribute that to sort of like the breakdown of community and community organizations. You know, people kind of gathered either in a local kind of setup, you know, in neighborhoods living together with community organizations, community balls, or like, you know, mass political movements, that kind of breaking down this sort of general atomization. Everyone is sort of like an individual siloed consumer and all that.
Yeah, I guess depending on where you come from, I think it's maybe kind of a healthy reaction to this new weird kind of isolation that people experience in, I guess, post-World War I Western life.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, the changes and the trends that have sort of just been accelerating, you know, over the past 50 to 100 years. Yeah, I mean, sort of there's this notion that a lot of... kind of dysfunction on that people exhibit or excessive coping behaviors are perhaps, you know, fairly natural responses to just the conditions of modern life, you know,
and, sure.
And insanity is sort of to be expected almost.
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of had this back and forth with Rafi on the book episode, but we were saying part of the experience of reading this book was wrestling page to page between feeling like, oh, this kind of sounds like a cringe edgelord 4chan Reddit guy or something, like the writing almost. We would oscillate between that and, you know what, I am actually pretty pissed off about like how much time I spend looking at stuff online, like shopping and, you know, fetishizing stuff.
Yeah.
But the where we ended up landing on, you know, is this cringe edge internet stuff, or like, is this, no, is there something more going on here? Is that there was more going on, and that this anger that was being expressed in the book wasn't just a whiny teenage anger, but it, it was a righteous anger at neoliberalism, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that the author talked about explicitly, maybe in the afterword of the book or somewhere. I remember him saying is part of it is just a slam at neoliberalism. Now we're drifting a little more towards politics. Just a quick qualifier here. I know you lean a little more to the left, far left on stuff. I don't really have any political beliefs, but I think that's somewhere where you and I do have common ground.
Yeah,
is that we share kind of that hatred of neoliberalism.
Yeah.
You might add the word neoliberal capitalism. And sure. I'd probably agree with you there too, especially in the context of this book. But
yeah, and I mean, I just definitionally, you know, neoliberalism as a phase or an offshoot of, you know, capitalism, you know, the previous dynamic of it, you know.
Sure. Well, they go hand in hand.
Right.
Kind
right.
of. But
yeah.
So, but just to wrap all that up, you agree, like, this isn't just a, you know, edgelord manifesto. There is, like, something you should be angry at here that the book's tapped into?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's like a lot of different maybe ideologies or pieces of media or polemics. It's kind of both. It's this edgelord thing, but it's also correctly identifying a problem. It derives its power and its popularity and its, you know, lasting cultural impact from correctly identifying something that is troubles a lot of people, that is a real problem that maybe, you know, doesn't get sort of properly addressed in mainstream culture, but then offers maybe not the best solution to it. And I think that's sort of this dynamic, you know, you see all these various different sort of more or less radical, you know, groups and identities and movements springing up all in response to this one central problem. And they each have their own proposed solution or their proposed diagnosis, you know. And
we're talking about the book more so than the movie, right? Because we just got through talking about how the movie pretty much throws all that away.
Well, it does at the end. I mean, the movie has elements, I think. Obviously, I'm not in a position to really do a thorough breakdown of the differences between the two. But I think there's elements of that in the film. I feel like my take on the film was that it was kind of very limited in scope, where its complaints are much more about consumer culture as opposed to maybe like larger issues of I don't know, inequality or general suffering or whatever, but specifically about sort of the malaise of the, I mean, in the case of the narrator, the decently well-off young professional who just has this hollow life based on consumer spending and no sort of sense of community or human bonding or warmth.
Yeah, and I buy that, them selling that feeling for the most part of the movie, but then it's also littered with Pepsi product placement.
Right. And I mean, the one moment that always really kind of rubbed me the wrong way was they're on that bus and Tyler, Brad Pitt, points out the Calvin Klein ad and, you know, something about, oh, are men supposed to look like that? And then it's like, dude, that is exactly what you look like, you know? And he's
oh, you're right. I never even thought about that.
He's
I don't remember that
cut.
From the book either.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, things get really ironic when you look at some of the kind of secondary downstream cultural, you know, products in response to Fight Club. You know, I think you actually, this was some years ago now, but I remember you talking to me about, it was like the Tyler Durden workout plan or something.
Oh yeah. Well, he's got like some insane fat percentage.
Or this was what Brad Pitt did for the film. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's kind of a funny irony to this too, but that body and the image of him in that movie has become like a coveted thing amongst workout people on the internet and fitness people, and there are tons of articles about how to get Tyler Durden's body, and
right, it's become an aspirational a brand
that
is being sold.
It totally has. And You know, maybe those people just coincidentally want the body because they're going through enlightenment or whatever, like the character in the movie. But part of me's got to wonder, like, does this whole thing just get turned into, I don't know, a bigger,
absorbed
an extension
back
of like middle class jerking off?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of the tragic fate of a lot of these things. You know, I think it was there's this sort of, you know, left wing academic author guy named Mark Fisher who wrote this little book called Capitalist Realism about, and one of his theses in that was about how all attempts to critique sort of the status quo, capitalism, the, you know, sort of the dynamics of our society today will eventually be, you know, smoothed over, defanged, reabsorbed back into the host organism and repurposed and become a hegemonic narrative, you know, that then reifies and goes back into supporting the existing structure.
Sure. And especially in the medium of a movie, just by nature, mm-hmm. you've got all these sexy stars. You've got to advertise it.
Right.
You've got to appeal to like the basic person who would go to a movie. All the things that the book is like kicking at the whole time.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I think it all comes back to the ending of the book versus the ending of the movie.
Mm.
And I mean, what it really reminds me of. Have you ever read Paradise Lost by John Milton?
I have not, unfortunately. It's on my list, though.
Well, the whole book is kind of structured as a joke on these same types of readers that you would, or watchers that you would have for Fight Club, because the book's main character is Satan, and no one can read the first two-thirds of this book without thinking that Satan is the coolest guy, that he's got, of course, like, he's cranky, like, there's this jerk over him that's telling him what to do, and things gotta be like this and this, and he's this dumb, like, dogmatic guy, and Satan is just, you know, super interesting, passionate, original, and you cannot help but root for him the whole time.
He's another hero, you know, being stifled by bureaucracy.
Yeah, until the final act of the, not the book, the poem, where John Milton shows you his true colors, and you're disgusted with him at first, and then the final blow is you realize, oh shoot, I've been rooting for this guy the whole time, and you feel terrible about yourself, and you realize, oh, I get what he was doing there. Like, this is like the seduction of all that stuff. It's exactly how it works. It has this sexy sheen, and you follow it to its conclusion, and it's this miserable, ugly thing.
Mm.
And that's exactly what the book did to Tyler with that last scene.
Mm.
But the movie just leaves him as, you know...
Yeah, on this kind of note of uncertainty, of possibility, like... You know, obviously...
Well, let's be honest. We thought he was cool. We liked him.
Yeah, I mean, his outfits went hard, you know? His hair, his glasses, his devil-may-care attitude, you know?
He had that, like...
suffered no fools.
The really sculpted V thing by his crotch that the Abercrombie models had that they show you a lot.
Right.
I mean, who's going to turn that down?
Yeah, I mean... you know, obviously mileage varies. I mean, there are moments in the film where you do really feel the bottom drop out. And I think, you know, a reasonable audience member could start to pull away, you know, the letting go of the steering wheel, driving at night and all that stuff. And obviously once Bob buys the farm, you know, which another fun fact interjection. So the meatloaf.
I love these fun fact moments.
Oh yes, I got more coming. There's been a log jam in the pipeline. So Meatloaf, he wore a 90-pound harness for his language.
Go ahead. We can always bleep it out.
All right. He wore a 90-pound harness to create his bits. And he also wore 8-inch lifts so that he'd be taller than Edward Norton on camera. And apparently, I was listening just last night. Apparently, you know, somebody wanted to get that harness either for memorabilia purposes or I don't know, reuse in another film or something. And Fincher said, That thing has been so sweat through by Meatloaf. Oh yeah, they wanted to take it for some kind of like one of those Hollywood
Meatloaf sweat.
That's something to be reckoned with.
God rest his soul.
R.I.P. but they wanted like one of those like Hollywood memorabilia restaurants wanted to acquire that harness. And apparently Fincher said that thing has been sweat through to such a degree. There's no way it would be legal to have it anywhere near, food, any kind of food service area. But so that's a little Meatloaf detail.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before we continue, a quick interruption. Want to purchase the book we're discussing in this episode? Well, check out Bookshop. Bookshop is an online bookstore with a mission to financially support local independent bookstores. As more and more people buy their books online, Bookshop has created an easy, convenient way for you to get your books and support bookstores at the same time. Bookshop will give away over 75% of their profit margin to stores, publications, and authors. If you want to shop the books we've covered on the podcast, visit the link down below in the description. We do receive a small commission based on sales, so thank you for all your support of our channel and podcast.
Well, they could take the cue of the book and dip it in somebody's soup.
That's true. Apparently a lot of details in the plot. I was listening to a little bit. I didn't get all the way through, sadly, but a little bit of Chuck Palahniuk's commentary along with Jim Ouels, who co-adapted the screenplay along with David Fincher. So it was Jim Ouels and Chuck Palahniuk on the commentary. And Chuck was saying how so many elements of the plot were pulled from his own experiences or those of his friends. And he was saying how, there were friends of his who were doing these, acts of stochastic terrorism in the food service industry, messing with the soups and all that, and a friend who was inserting reels into the film, as a projectionist.
That's why I always try to tell a lot of my associates are Greek people, and a lot of the times they'll air like every complaint they have to waiters, and I just want to reach out and shake them like, you're eating cum. Or boogers. We'll bleep that part and we'll use that.
Yeah, well, that's...
No, it's definitely a real thing.
Yeah, and that's, even in the absence of any kind of, like, really organized, disciplined, militant sort of, class antagonism or class movement, you still get these individual acts of rebellion and whatnot. Just individual people, flipping the bird, like the whatever Eminem lyric, but from The Real Slim Shady. But earlier you were touching on the ways that the film only reinforces consumer culture and whatnot, and I think we've talked in the past over the years this movie's been a part of our lives for a long time about kind of the contradiction and the problem with trying to adapt the themes of the Fight Club story in a film, which is part of the studio system, which is getting all this financing and supported by product placement possibly. And there was actually a quote from Fincher that I found kind of interesting, which I feel like sort of addresses that, or at least continues that sort of dialogue. Let's see if I can find it here. Okay. Here I have it.
It'd be like trying to release a movie version of Das Kapital or something.
Yeah, which,
in the American movie system.
Yeah. Well,
not to go on a tangent there, but sorry, finish your thing.
Yeah. Warren Beatty did that movie Reds, and there was the...
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I mean either, but I want to. And Judas and the Black Messiah about Fred Hampton.
I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, but there is an inherent sort of tension that has to be sort of navigated. But Fincher talked about the process of the... the film really, getting rolling and him getting on board with making the film. And sort of the background was, his first feature film after doing music videos and commercials, ironically, a lot of commercials.
Well, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. Right?
That's what some people say. Yeah.
That's one of the best trapdoors ever.
So Fincher's debut film was Alien 3.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And it was a terrible experience for him.
So I only saw the first Alien. That's one of the ones where it became like a big, dumb action movie, right?
Well, I think the sort of consensus that I've seen about Alien 3 is that it's kind of this beautiful disaster, and it's great looking, and there's hints of what could have been, but it was totally butchered by the studio. They totally intervened, pushed him around, you know, this new feature film director with not a lot of clout and so on. The final product was nothing near what he wanted. It's not like Alien versus Predator. It's not like this huge, big, dumb thing. I think it doesn't really work. But, you know, it's got Charles Dance, Tywin Lannister.
Oh, I like that guy.
Yeah, it's like on some kind of prison colony or something. So I think that there are interesting things about it. It's this sort of interesting artifact, you know, what could have been and all that. But after that terrible experience, you know, Fincher almost wrote off feature filmmaking. He was interested in Fight Club from the jump. He wanted to buy the rights to it himself, but Fox, the same studio, bought the rights instead. And so then he thought...
That's kind of funny.
Yes, one of many ironies all throughout the whole saga here. But then, you know, he got word, you know, his agents and so on were telling him, well, Fox has changed, there's new leadership, you know, you might have a better experience this time around. And so a dialogue started. And sort of the options that were presented were, or at least that he conceived of, was he could go two ways with Fight Club. He could do a $3 million budget, more of like a micro budget, like tiny art film. Get very limited distribution. You know, maybe it shows in a few art cinemas here and there. You know, some snob is going to find it in 10 years and say that it's an underrated masterpiece. Or maybe it'll get no theatrical release. Maybe it'll go straight to DVD.
Oof.
Or option B, he gets something in the range of a $50 million budget. And in the end, it ended up being like 65, something like that, which allows him to get some big name stars and draw.
Run into those CGI sex scenes with Helena Bonham Carter, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, lots of CGI. I mean, he uses CGI in a really playful and creative way. You know, no aliens and whatnot. And get a larger, you know, audience and reach more people with, and the word he used was make this seditious movie and get more people to see it. And he chose option B.
It ended up being a flop at the box office, didn't it?
Well, you see, yeah, that's the interesting thing. It was a box office flop, very polarizing reactions from critics. Ebert gave it this middling review, 2 out of 4 stars. I have several quotes from his review that I
found. In his khaki pants.
Yeah. And then it ended up recouping and becoming this big hit on home video.
Sure, a huge cult movie.
Right. And very much situated in its specific time and place, you know, back when home video was still a big thing, you know, with physical media and DVDs and then later Blu-rays, you know, pre-streaming, but, you know, after the advent of home video. So it's this cult phenomenon, this late 90s, early 2000s cult phenomenon that could only happen at that moment. But that sort of presented, you know, this quote from him presented this interesting thought to me of like, well, if for an artist or an activist or a propagandist, someone who's trying to get a message out there, to have it be received, to have an audience, is it worth the compromises that come with using this studio system, using the resources available under the current system, is that still justified if you're still reaching more people, you know? And I guess maybe the direction that we're taking it with our conversation is maybe not, because it was just sort of neutered, you know, beyond recognition. But
the movie, you mean?
Yes, yeah, as compared to the book.
I don't know, because, I mean, I keep thinking about going back to the book, which was a great book, and it was, this guy made it, and I don't think he thought about any of this stuff. It was just, I don't think he was even one of these writers that gets tripped up by being more interested in the ideas that they have to say than just wanting to write a good story and pay attention to the craft of that. But this, the after effect I guess. So are you asking the question, does the movie work? Can it, like, still hold the message of that book?
Well,
Or, like, yeah, can you pull something like that off, like a Clockwork Orange sort of thing? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like, does making a film with a larger budget with stars in the studio system automatically disqualify it from having, you know, more radical potential or having a genuine, valuable critique of the status quo? I mean, is it worth working with, you know, the things that you're critiquing in order to reach as large an audience as possible?
I don't know. I think it depends on the kind of clarity of vision that your audience is going to have coming to it, which probably the studio directors and people who financed this and put it together didn't really care about. Mm. But I mean, we're talking about it right now. I'm glad it exists, and it's an entertaining movie.
Yeah.
But there's a downside to it too,
right?
Which is, I think the not treatment, but kind of the thing this movie has morphed into on the internet,
right?
Kind of that the same thing that's happened with American Psycho, where that meme, Patrick Bateman stuff is on fire right now, and especially with Zoomer type people. You get the sense that, you know, this is just like a funny, kind of cool character to them. And no, seriously, I mean, it's everywhere. And I mean, this could splinter off into the whole toxic masculinity discussion. But
right.
There are, I think, a lot of young American guys that are really hurting and really lost and alienated and are just starving for an image of a man with power, and anything else could be attached to that. But I think it's in their DNA to gravitate towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And without all the proper qualifiers around it, like the book has, if you give it a fair reading, that it ends up taking you in the same direction that the main character goes in the book, where you implode.
Cautionary tale.
I mean, if we want to get a little Jungian about it, I mean, that's where this is a primal story. It's just a guy who is trying to integrate his shadow self, his aggression. But I mean, the caveats that Jung gives for that are, if you don't find aggression is great, anger is great, especially as a man, but if you don't find something bigger to contextualize all of that in and kind of bridle it, it will end up eating you from the inside out.
Right.
Like the narrator in the book.
Yeah.
And I think that's, when I said the consequence, that's the consequence of making something like this into a movie, is you will have a lot of
people who take the wrong message.
Yes. Untrained people consuming this.
Undisciplined.
That it might end up hurting in the long run.
Yeah.
They become a gym bro. They, now there's anything wrong with that in itself. But
right. Yeah. That's also a path to, you know, a lot of positive outcomes.
They reduce it down to just like, here's a tough, cool, edgy guy that can beat someone up and is physically attractive. And right. That's where it ends.
Aspirational. Yeah.
But it can't end there.
Yeah, and I don't know, for me, I guess, you know, sort of a lefty angle or whatever, it almost comes down to, like, you know, it's this identification of a problem of identity and community, isolation, and so on. But the solutions proposed are still sort of confined within this very restrictive framework that's very solipsistic and very focused on yourself as the individual and actualizing through this conception of masculinity, building yourself up by destroying yourself and others and that sort of thing. But it sort of lacks a really rigorous critique of the status quo and sort of like a rigorous and holistic analysis. And it fails to sort of envision, I mean, ironically, you know, maybe by accident in the film, I guess they end up manifesting more of a social change by, you know, erasing all the debt. But largely, you know, the idea of the Fight Club and so on is very much turning inward and sort of incapable of imagining a different society, building a different society, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and also with the book's kind of angle on people, I think you'd have to assume that if all those people's debt got erased, like the average American that the book is slamming, they'd just go and buy more shit.
Yeah, I guess if that's kind of the misanthropic angle that it's taking.
Also, I got to add, the Chinese version of the movie ends with the same thing. It's like, instead of the buildings blowing up, and this is super interesting, actually. It cuts before the buildings blow up, and it has a text insert come on screen. It says, because of his own incompetence or something like that, the
heroic efforts of police.
Yeah, the buildings did not blow up. The police came in and saved everything.
Order was restored.
They ended up giving you the message of the book.
Right, tracking with the original novel. Yeah,
that was cute there to me. But so just to sum all that up, you kind of agree with me, like,
It's a flawed delivery, a compromised delivery of the thesis of the book.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose if it's an all right time, I can maybe deliver some of Ebert's little zingers.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
I've been thirsting for those Ebert zingers.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, another RIP, you know, gone but not forgotten.
He should have joined the Fight Club.
Yeah, that... Should I make a joke about a glass jaw? I don't know. All right. So, okay. So, Ebert, he called it fascist. He called it macho porn. He called it little boy posturing. But he did qualify that it was very well made with a great first act. And he said that it had some of the most brutal, unremitting, nonstop violence ever filmed, which, I don't know, I feel like that's a little hyperbolic.
He called it a masculine porn, and what was this, posturing?
Macho porn and little boy posturing.
Oh, I think Ebert has low T.
I don't know. I mean, well, I won't make another medical joke at his expense.
God rest his soul.
Yes. And let's see. He described how in the fight scenes, the sound effects guys beat the hell out of a sofa with ping pong paddles for the punch noises and all that. You know, homoerotic undertones. He described it, I guess, sort of in its moment, you know, the types of films that are being made at that point with all the twists and rug pulls of the audience. He said it had Kaiser Soze syndrome.
I haven't seen that movie.
Actually, me neither, but of course I know what he's talking about. And I think you'll like this. He said that Tyler Durden sounds like he tripped over the Nietzsche display on his way to the coffee bar in a bookstore.
I mean, that's what I was kind of getting at earlier with, you know, the page-to-page struggle of this book, of the Reddit forum feeling versus, you know, righteous anger. But I don't know. I mean, I do think this book is a great encapsulation of the will to power idea from Nietzsche.
Okay, interesting.
I don't know how familiar you are with any of his stuff. If you were ever in middle school and wore like all black for a year like I did. But
I think I didn't have that phase. No, I thought I would have caught that.
But yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the virtues of the book to me is I think it does good service of that idea, which is, I think, a demonstrably real thing. I mean, Nietzsche, just his thesis about all that is, you know, there's a big amorphous mass of people doing nothing, and out of that, there's a handful of ubermensch guys who will go through the pain and the struggle to actualize themselves, accrue power, and project their will and their image of the world onto things until reality is bent to that vision.
Like the Nicholson character from The Departed. He wants his environment to be a product of him.
Sure, yeah. And I think this is a fair treatment of that. Okay. But
well, yeah.
I mean, you can't. Nietzsche is one of the most. His books are extremely dense and rigorous, and
another author who I think there's a lot of contention over the heritage and the legacy, and you know who owns sort of Nietzsche's ideas and what they actually mean. You know, which ideology they support, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, good luck to anyone who's going to try and distill Nietzsche into a movie.
Right. Which that wasn't even.
I mean, his books you could use to as a doorstop.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But the basic idea from, again, I'm not a Nietzsche scholar. I've read some of his stuff, but I thought it was a pretty good distillation of that.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, you know.
But then again, I mean, people. Like the Reddit people, they're going to run with these one-liners from Tyler.
Yes, these very accessible kind of...
That are reductions of Nietzsche, I guess you... So I guess that's maybe fair from Ebert.
Yeah, and of course, he's talking about the film.
So. Yeah, yeah, of course.
And yeah, just rounding it out, last couple lines, you know, and sort of truncating a little bit here. Although the film ultimately presents an argument against the behavior of Tyler... he suspects the audience will like the behavior, but not the argument.
I think that's good.
Yeah. And then the last one I got was that it's a thrill ride masquerading as philosophy. But,
yeah. Well, I think I agree with the E-man on all this.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, he had so the juice. Far. Yeah. But, if we have time, if we're able, I didn't want to, just dump on the film the whole time. Some things that I really appreciated about the film, just, you know, outside of its particular thematics, was just, you know, Fincher as a director, having such sort of, you know, formal mastery and really playing with film form, to communicate ideas and aspects of the book in ways that only a movie can, you know, which I always appreciate. It makes it very lively. And I feel like, especially with the state of movie making nowadays, there's so many mainstream movies that are just so inert and so static and that don't really make full use of all the tools at their disposal. But Fincher is always someone who there's so much craft and detail into all the little moments.
Especially this movie. And now I'm dipping my toe into your lane here where I don't really belong.
Oh, but, welcome.
This movie has like so much motion even amongst his other stuff, which I thought was really fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A lot of like whip pans and other camera moves. And obviously, you know, Fincher, he kind of is famous for his uncanny camera movements, you know, CGI camera moves, crane operated stuff, sort of impossible camera movements, things that had to have been, done with CGI in some way or another because you couldn't, you know, possibly imagine how a camera operator could do it physically.
And that tells me that he must have really studied the book here before he did it, because, I mean, that's the form reflecting content. The part of what Polanyi said the book came out of was a writing exercise he gave himself where he wanted to write a short story where there was absolutely no exposition leading up to things. It was only the cuts to action. And the movie I think does a great job of that.
Yeah,
it just has this frenetic like relentless feeling.
Yeah, constant motion, constant energy. In that commentary with Chuck Palahniuk and Jim Ouels, they described how the first act, to the extent that you can even cleanly separate the film into acts, is basically almost structured as one long montage with constant like flashbacks and then flashback within the flashback and then kind of sudden jarring, you know, flash forwards, which obviously that reflects the narrator's fractured state of mind, him losing time, you know, him falling asleep and waking up in places where he doesn't realize what's happened. And one moment that really grabbed me that I thought was really cool is that Edward Norton literally gets yanked across a cut. So he's in one scene. In fact, I think he's it's the very first scene. They've done that big 90-second, you know, CGI pullout where it starts off at the microscopic level in the fear center of his brain, pulls out across all the neurons and everything, emerges out his mouth, tracks up the barrel of that pistol, and then we have the scene there. And it's in media res. Obviously, we'll return to that later in the film. Throws you right in the action, very disorienting. And then Edward Norton is standing there in frame, and he suddenly gets yanked And then it cuts, and he's yanked into the bosom of Bob.
Yeah. And I mean, that was pretty accurate to the start of the book, too. Mm. I mean, that's one thing I appreciated was you got the sense this was a director that really gave a crap about the thing he was turning into a movie. But
which is, you know, sort of why it's tragic that there were these compromises to the thematics, you know, even with his dedication.
Yeah, but I mean, I think my final thoughts on it are he did a great job. And from what I understand about the production, his hands were tied by these decisions the producers and whoever else wanted to make about Tyler. Mm. And I don't fault David Fincher at all. I think he did the best he could with in light of that.
Mm.
And he couldn't have predicted the meme diarrhea that would happen later. And
yeah,
the,
when you put something out in the world, you never know what they'll do with it.
Furthering of the bondage of a young, confused American man. But, you know, you can predict these things.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess we're sort of in a wrap-up phase.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess as a sort of closing thought for me as well. Yeah, I do recognize the thematic problems, the compromises that exist, the contradictions that the film can't really resolve. But I still really enjoy it just as a piece of entertainment, as a piece of filmmaking craft, and also just as an artifact historically and how it's precisely situated, you know, in particular the fact that it feels very modern, very self-aware, a lot of fourth wall breaks. And yet there are changes that have happened since the film was made that date it in really interesting ways. I mean, for one thing, you know, you have all this CGI and all this camera trickery and very slick stuff, but it was made in 99. It was shot on film and predating this transition to digital camera and digital filmmaking. And the technology of the characters, I mean, you have the Edward Norton character, you know, on the phone with the Sears catalog or IKEA or whomever ordering furniture that way. I don't think that really happens like that so much anymore, you know?
No.
Predating all these digital marketplaces and kind of I feel like the atomization and whatnot that it addresses has just been hyper accelerated ever since then with the advent and popularization of the internet as it exists now, you know?
Sure. And that's what I was thinking when you said time capsule.
Yeah.
Of course, I wasn't like a sentient adult or anything back then, but
right. In
retrospect, it does seem like a encapsulation of that moment and that kind of mental rabies everyone was having at the turn of the century, right before we tipped over the edge completely and dove headfirst into the internet world. But
yeah.
You said atomized. I'm going to have to wrangle you back on here for a Michelle Welbeck episode because this was just... way too much fun.
Yeah, man, I had a blast, and yeah, so I need to finally read that. I know I've really let you down by not reading it yet, but I am going to, and yeah, that seems like a perfect deadline. And if I can squeeze in a closing thought, it's so funny how in a lot of ways Fight Club is now similar to its peers in this moment of malaise, the brief end of history in the late 90s before history started back up again with a vengeance. Where, you know, like the opening of The Matrix, like Office Space, you know, like a lot of other films, like American Beauty, it's now almost this nostalgic depiction of economic security and a job with nice benefits in a nice office. You know, it's aspirational for a lot of people now who are like gig workers or whatever. You know, it's like, God, I wish I had it like they do, you know? But.
Well, that was a lot of fun. Thank you, Thomas.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. This has been a total blast.
Of course. I hope we can do it again soon.
Mm.
Everyone watching, listening, make sure you please like and subscribe. And remember, if a book is banned, it's worth reading, even though this was a movie that we were talking about also.
Yes. Well, a transmedia empire, right?
Trans empire, indeed.